Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Today, we explore the question of who is the fiscal conservative in the race? Who is it that is most likely to protect our government's budget and our taxpayers' money in the future? You know, it's interesting that a number of you, in fact, I had an interesting call with Nathan just last Sunday, a conservative from Ohio, who was saying that he is a social liberal, but a fiscal conservative. What he cares about is the budget. He cares about the budget deficit. And he was listening to all those ads the Republicans are running, saying that John Kerry is a tax and spend liberal, supporting all these big government programs that John Kerry can't fund. And Nathan was thinking of voting for George W. Bush. Well, I got news for you, Nathan. It ain't like that. If the sole thing that you care about is you're a fiscal conservative, I would argue your candidate is John Kerry. And two members of Congress agree with me. I'm going to have on the show today Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia, and then later on, former Republican Congressman Michael Forbes of New York. Both of them care about budget deficits and believe that Bush has gone too far. And if you want to call in and ask them questions, feel free to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. First, I want to welcome Congressman Bobby Scott to the Inside Scoop.
Mark, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
I know you're busy in a campaign yourself. I really appreciate you taking the time from the campaign trail to appear on my show.
Well, thank you.
Let me delve right into the issue. There are a number of people that will tell you across the country they're social liberals. They believe in a woman's right to choose. They believe in civil rights. They support the environment, education, health care. But they're fiscal conservatives. They're concerned about budget deficits. And, hey, George Bush is going around with all these ads arguing that John Kerry's a big spending liberal. What would you say to someone like that?
I'd say that I was elected in 1992 and 1993. We came in and faced a $290 billion deficit, and in 8 years had converted it into enough of a surplus to pay off the national debt held by the public by 2009. In 4 years, that projection has come to a complete end, and instead of paying off the national debt held by the public by 2009 and paying zero interest on that debt, the interest on the debt for 2009 will be $300 billion.
Okay, but
By 2014, the interest on the national debt is going to rival the defense budget.
Well, let's take it apart piece by piece. First, let's talk about the Clinton years. I got a Republican, Ed, from New Jersey, who writes in on my blog that it was Newt Gingrich that gets all the credit for the budget surpluses of the 90s. You agree?
No.
Okay.
Because when the budget passed in 1993, it passed by a slim margin, and not a single Republican in the House or the Senate voted for that budget. And it significantly reduced the deficit. In 1995, after the Republicans took over the House and the Senate by complaining about our fiscally responsible votes, the Republicans passed a huge tax cut that President Clinton vetoed. Tax cuts about the same size as the ones that President Bush signed. President Clinton vetoed them. The Republicans passed it again and threatened to close down the government. President Clinton vetoed them. They closed down the government, and he vetoed them again. He wouldn't sign those irresponsible budgets. As a result, we ended up with a surplus that eliminated the deficit, balanced the budget, went into surplus. Now, when President Bush came in, we saw what would have happened if President Clinton had signed those budgets, because in 3 years, instead of just take this year, for example. This year, when President Clinton left office, the projected surplus for 2004 budget that just ended, the year just ended, fiscal year just ended, was almost $400 billion surplus. When we finished counting at the end of last year, it looks like it's going to be over $400 billion deficit, a swing of $800 billion. Now, if Newt Gingrich says they want to take credit for the budgets they passed that President Clinton vetoed, that's absurd. The fact is that the swing of $800 billion, they put $800 billion in perspective. If you add up everybody's individual income tax, aggregate total throughout the country adds up to about $800 billion. That's how much this year's budget has deteriorated in just 4 years of the Bush administration.
So to make up for George Bush, we'd have to pay pretty much twice the amount of taxes next year to make up.
To get back to where we would have, where we were projected to be, we'd have to pay a surcharge of 100% on our income tax to get back to where we were. Now, for the Republicans to try to take credit for the fact that President Clinton vetoed their budgets, that's about the height of absurdity.
Okay.
We know what would have happened if President Clinton had signed those budgets, and it happened because we saw President Bush sign those budgets, and this year's budget drooped $800 billion. Now, the interest on the national debt for 2009, like I said, $300 billion, let's put that number in perspective. If you hired people at $30,000 each, how many people could you hire with $300 billion that we're going to be paying in interest and getting nothing for? Answer, 10 million people you could hire with the interest on the national debt at $30,000 each for 2009. Incidentally, there are only less than 9 million people drawing unemployment today.
So you could actually,
number in perspective.
All you have to do is take Bush's deficit, and if you put that entirely into jobs, you'd wipe out the unemployed.
Not the interest on the national debt.
Oh, just
the
interest.
Interest on the national debt.
Okay.
In 2009 and going forward, the interest on the national debt would be enough to eliminate unemployment in the United States.
All right, let me give out the toll-free number again. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. I just have Mr. Scott on for about 10 more minutes, so if you want to call in, here's your chance now. Mr. Scott, I want to ask you, some people will say, okay, but there's this debt, but it's just a bunch of numbers, and it's a huge number, and we can pay it back way in the future. Why does it really matter?
Well, there are two things. One is the debt is somewhat esoteric. That's why we talk about interest on the national debt. By 2014, in our 10-year budget, interest on the national debt would be equivalent to the defense budget. Now, if you want to, we're not paying enough for bulletproof vests and reinforced trucks in Iran. We're underfunding veterans health care right now. Our Navy is not building enough ships to maintain the 300-ship Navy that everybody believes that would be an appropriate number. The money is not there, and if you put it in interest in the national debt, you're not funding port security and homeland security, airline security. Things are being underfunded in the national security area. We cannot be safer if we're spending all our money in interest in the national debt.
Well, one of my callers, actually it's a blogger, I should say, it's Nathan, and I know he's a conservative. He's blogged in before. He says that he actually praises Clinton for balancing the budget, but says that we were cutting intelligence at the time, and that he doesn't blame George Bush for the deficit because we need the money to fund the war in Afghanistan and intelligence and other things at home. Is he wrong?
The war is being mismanaged. We have appropriated $200 billion and no end in sight in the war in Iraq. Have the listeners kind of think for a second. How much did it cost us to defeat Iraq 14 years ago in the Persian Gulf War? We got $200 billion, no end in sight. How much did it cost to defeat them? $7.4 billion.
$7 billion. $7 billion compared to $225 billion today. That's quite a bargain.
No end in sight. We haven't finished yet. And that's because, I mean, the war cost more than that 14 years ago, but we had allies. It wasn't just my way or the highway. We had allies. They paid most of the cost. Now we're paying not only most of the cost, but suffering virtually all of the casualties.
Well, how do you answer the Republicans that say, well, the reason we're in a deficit is because we're in a war and we're fighting the war and it's not really about the tax cuts?
The war should cost us $7.4 billion. Why are we $400 billion in debt?
What percentage is the tax cuts a part of the deficit?
Most of it is in tax cuts. Trillions of dollars in the 10-year budget going to tax cuts. That's what has put us in the hole. And if we are going into war, what adjustment in the budget strategy was made? The 9/11 was in 2001. We haven't changed. The Bush administration said we're going to cut taxes. We had 9/11. We continued going. I mean, it's like driving over a bridge and seeing that the bridge has been, you know, there's a hole in the bridge 2 miles up. Well, you ought to slow down and adjust for these guys, just full-speed adjustment in the budget to accommodate a war, no adjustment in the budget in terms of taxes and revenue to accommodate the 9/11, when we passed $87 billion, they didn't even give lip service as to how to pay for it. They didn't lip service like one day we might have to sacrifice. They just spent the money.
What's interesting about the $87 billion is the Republican talking heads, they go on the air all the time complaining about Kerry not supporting the troops, they say, with the $87 billion, when, of course, Kerry and I assume most of the Democrats voted for the $87 billion if it were paid for.
And it was paid for. There's another thing. I think anybody that voted for that thing ought to be ashamed of themselves because no questions were asked. $87 billion. Incidentally, let's put some things in perspective. 87 plus the 79 we'd already spent was 166, which happened to be more than we spent that year on the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Education, and the Department of Transportation, and the Department of State, and Department of Labor aggregate combined. Peter, they question, where are the allies? Well, you're not patriotic. What is the exit strategy? You're not strong on terror against terrorism. Why is Halliburton getting paid twice as much for gasoline than everybody else? Oh, you must not be patriotic. I mean, no questions were asked, and if we had asked those questions, we would have known one thing, that they got so many contractors over there that aren't under anybody's control. We would have found out that contractors were doing these interrogations, that contractors are doing what are really military functions. We would have found out a lot if anybody had asked the questions, but nobody asked any questions.
And, of course, those contractors are a lot more expensive than either our soldiers or of course, Iraqis to do the work. Let me go to some of our phones. They're blinking. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Congressman Bobby Scott.
Hey, folks. This is Dave on the Internet from California.
Hi, Dave.
One of the things that's not computing in my head, what must this Bush team be elected? Would they not expect to be having the economy collapse, Social Security coming to an end? One person's offered the theory to me that sees it as his divine role to be helping God bring about Armageddon.
Huh.
He has no plan for turning this thing around, does he?
Well, let me ask Mr. Scott.
Yes, he does. And he's gonna, if you look at the Social Security Trust Fund cash flow graph, you will notice that between now and 2017, there's more money coming in than going out. After 2017, the deficit starts running up big time, almost out of control. But if you look at what this administration has in store for the top 1%, if that money had been put into Social Security rather than tax cuts for the top 1%, we could have paid Social Security without reducing benefits, without increasing the age of retirement for 75 years.
You know, it's interesting. I hear a lot of Republicans complain about Social Security, saying there's no solution, we're not going to get it. People forget.
We had a choice. Social Security taking off, no changes, 75 years, or tax cuts for the 1%. We gave tax cuts for the 1%. Now, the president, if you look at the graphs, look at the budgets, it is clear that this president has no intention of paying Social Security after about 2017. And listen to him very carefully when he says, we must preserve Social Security for those who are on Social Security. Wait a minute. What about everybody else? Then he starts mumbling and grumbling about some individual accounts as if, well, in an age of personal responsibility, if you're not already on Social Security, your retirement will be your personal responsibility. It won't be any Social Security. We could have had Social Security solvent and secure if we'd put the same amount of money into Social Security that we had for the top 1% of taxpayers, but we made the choice.
Yeah, that is,
we're going to cut taxes and worry about Social Security and Medicare later.
It's an interesting point, and I think it's a good subtle distinction a lot of people aren't getting. George Bush has promised to preserve Social Security for those who are on it now. But for those of us that have put money into the system, and including people who are close to retirement, you can lose everything under George Bush's Social Security plan. Let me go to another caller. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine, Congressman Bobby Scott.
Hey, Congressman. Hey, Mark. This is Steve in Atlanta.
Hi, Steve.
You know, we're talking about all these tax cuts, and, you know, you kind of presume that the Democrats are, you know, I'm a Democrat myself, are on the right side of this, but we had this huge corporate windfall the other week, and wasn't that passed by, like, 97% of the Senate?
That's a very good point. Steve, I assume you're referring to the kind of the pork bill, the one that gave all those tax cuts to corporations? Is that
yes,
the one?
Sir.
That's a great question. Mr. Scott?
Well, it passed. I didn't vote for it because it was, as it has been described, a giveaway. We had a $4 billion problem. We had some international customs kinds of issues going on that we needed, frankly, a $4 billion fix to it. But by the time they loaded it up, it was about a $150 billion solution. Now, under the Clinton administration, one of the ways we maintained fiscal responsibility was that we had a thing called PAYGO, pay as you go. You want to cut taxes, you got to raise some taxes somewhere or cut spending to pay for it. If you want to have a new program, spending program, you got to raise the taxes to pay for it or cut some other program. Pay as you go. It was that way for the 8 years of the Clinton administration. That evaporated, and that's how you can have these huge unpaid-for tax cuts. That's how you can have a $400 billion Medicare prescriptive drug bill, which is basically tax cuts for the corporations and giveaways to HMOs and insurance companies and protection for pharmaceutical companies. And whatever fell off the truck, the senior citizen might get as a prescriptive drug benefit. But it didn't have to be paid for, so it just goes straight to the bottom line in deficit.
Well,
what we need to do is to restore fiscal integrity, fiscal responsibility, and make sure that that we can return to the fiscally responsible days that we had when Bill Clinton was in office.
And it seems to be that the House is more responsible at this than the Senate. Why is that? Why is it that these senators would always bitch about this? You know, when
I was surprised that thing could pass by the margin it passed by. I'm frankly surprised.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you very much for your call. Mr. Scott, I do have to stick up for the caller there. I know about this bill, and I'm very glad that you voted against it. I think that shows courage on your part, given all the pork that was in it. But it included things like, I know, tobacco subsidies. There was a subsidy for bow and arrow manufacturers, for fish tackle boxes, Chinese ceiling fans, even one for foreign gamblers. It was an amazing pork-filled bill, and you know, I know the Democrats early on very much fought against this bill, but at the end of the day, did they just stuff too much pork in it and everyone signed on?
Well, everybody, you know, there's a lot of pork, a lot of people. And see, when you don't have the PAYGO, then it's the question of do you want tax cuts or not? Usually, it's do you want tax cuts at the cost of spending cuts or other tax increases or what? I mean, that you just don't. There's no parking right here. You know, if it's just do you want tax cuts or not without having to pay for it, those are easy decisions. Of course, everybody wants tax cuts.
So in other words, when you remove the caps, the budget caps, that then suddenly it's a free for all. Everybody just tries to grab whatever part of the government they can.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you don't have to pay for it, then it's all popularity. How many people are for increased spending? I mean, there's a joke about a longtime congressman. He asked, how'd you stay in the office so long? He said, well, I voted in favor of all appropriations, and I voted against all taxes. Well, you know, that's nice rhetoric, but, I mean, it doesn't add up after a while.
Why do you think the Democratic Party and John Kerry in particular would be better at this in the future than George Bush?
You look at the record. When the Democrats came in 93, after the 92 election, we had a $290 billion deficit growing by leaps and bounds. We cast the tough votes. Every year during the Clinton administration, the deficit was less or the surplus was more. And as soon as the Bush administration came in, they spent all the cash surplus and went into the Medicare trust fund. By August of 2001, before September 11th, by the next year, it was all downhill. Now we have a deficit of $400 billion, the largest deficit, I think it rivals World War II, the kind of deficits we were running, at least on a dollar-to-dollar basis. I'm not sure if you adjust for inflation, but, I mean, it's certainly outside of a world war. We didn't run up these kind of deficits during Vietnam.
Let me go to another call.
Johnson had almost a balanced budget. In the Vietnam War.
Let me go to another caller. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Congressman Bobby Scott.
Hi, Mark. It's Brian from New Hampshire.
Hey, Brian.
Yeah, I'd like to say that we're not talking about it. I'm going by a book, The Looting of Social Security by Dr. Alan W. Smith, page 39 here. No president prior to Ronald Reagan had access to significant surplus Social Security revenue. But then it goes on to say that Reagan's successor, George Bush the First, he had a $211.7 billion Social Security surplus. He diverted it all into the coffers of his budget, his so-called off-budget spending. And now this current George the Second is continuing that he's spending over, I think it's close to $2 trillion of the Social Security surplus to pay for his rich and corporations' tax cuts and wars all over the world. And why aren't you people taking the Republicans on this when the Democratic Congress fixed Social Security back in the 1980s and now it's being, again, stolen away by the Republicans? The workers in their future retirement is being stolen away by the Republicans. Why? I'd like to hear some comment on that.
I think you're talking about the arithmetic of the fact that we could have maintained Social Security benefits without reducing benefits or increasing the age of retirement to 75 years with just what the top 1% got out of the tax cut. Top 1%.
Absolutely.
So we had a choice. Fix Social Security or give the top 1% a tax cut. Now, when I talk to young people, I tell them that we are stealing their Social Security to give tax cuts to the wealthy, and they're sitting around not registered to vote, letting us get away with it.
That's right. The fault remains with the Republican leadership of this country, the so-called elected presidential administration of this country, and no one's brought this up during this entire so-called campaign, and I'm wondering why they get away with such total theft of the workers' future of this country, the citizens' future, that the Social Security has been the safest insurance program in the history of mankind. From what I understand, it's the safest. It's not a stock market bet. And you can't leave this senior citizen's future to the stock market, the whims of the stock market. Most of us are not Alan Greenspan. We're not George Soros. We don't know how to get this kind of investment for our future. The Social Security is Social Security. That it shouldn't be touched. It's like health care being turned into an industry instead of health care.
Brian, thank you very much for your call.
When you heard the 2000 debates, you heard a concept called lockbox. That is a surplus. The temporary surplus should be put in a lockbox and saved and invested for future Social Security and not spent. When this administration came in, the lockbox idea just went out the window and it's back to spending the surplus, and it will not be there when the next generation wants to retire.
You know, Congressman,
we need to go back to the way we had it. We're running up surpluses, so when the Social Security goes into a deficit, we got some money to pay for it, and the money was there.
Congressman, I remember a lot of people made fun of Al Gore and the lockbox. Saturday Night Live had a skit on it. Everyone was making fun of this lockbox. But, of course, George Bush has broken into the lockbox and taken all the Social Security funds. I think the caller's point, though, is why aren't the Democrats focusing on this more? How would you answer that?
I don't know, but I speak about it every time, particularly when I speak to young groups. I talk every time I give a speech, I talk about the budget mess that we're in. This is absolutely outrageous that we'd be sitting up here allowing the next generation's Social Security to get hijacked to fund tax cuts for the wealthy. The top 1% got would be enough to fund Social Security for 75 years.
75 years.
Anybody that's 18 years old and not voting ought to be ashamed of themselves because we're stealing their Social Security.
That's an amazing statistic, and it bears repeating that if you repeal the top 1%, what they got into the tax cut, that alone would fund Social Security for 75 years. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine, Congressman Bobby Scott.
Yeah, this is 464 from Michigan.
Okay, hello, 464.
I think you guys are talking some amazing statistics. One thing I'd like to bring up is that a question about the status of U.S. as a debtor nation on the world community. How does this affect the world market, and how does this...
Great question. Thank you for your call. Mr. Scott,
I think the first thing you ought to look at is how does it affect our national security. China and Japan are buying up a substantial portion of our paper. As a matter of fact, on a net balance, foreign nations are buying up almost as much foreign debt of our debt as Americans. That puts us into, that has national security implications. Certainly, if Colin Powell went over to China and said, stop building nuclear weapons, and China said, if you don't shut up and leave, get out of here, we're going to stop buying your paper, what's Colin Powell going to do? China, if they sold what they had, I mean, your mortgage would double overnight. I mean, we're sitting up here paying these 3.5%, 4%, 5%, 6% mortgages. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that when a 10% mortgage was a bargain. It wouldn't take much foreign shenanigans to put us right back in that situation.
Mr. Scott, who does?
So then President Clinton at the National Convention said, how are you going to enforce your trade policies against your banker? I mean, you know, the trade, international trade, balance of trade. Are we going to tell China? We're going to tell them to stop dumping steel or something like that in the United States when they're sitting up here buying all our paper? We can't negotiate. We have no strength. So it has national security and foreign policy implications when they are buying up a lot of our debt. I saw one statistic that said if every dime of savings in America went to buying the debt, we wouldn't be able to buy all of the debt we're putting out there. We need foreign governments to bail us out.
Mr. Scott, who are our bankers?
If a third world country was in this situation, we wouldn't give them any foreign aid until they got their act together.
Mr. Scott, who are our bankers? China, you mentioned, is Saudi Arabia a big player? Who are they?
China and Japan are the biggest at this point.
China and Japan. Okay. I got one last question for you. It's from Nathan. He said that he doesn't think we should be using a surplus to subsidize Social Security. He thinks Social Security needs to be a self-sustaining unit. How do you answer that?
Well, it is. It's supposed to be self-sustaining, but the deal is that because of demographics, we need to load up on it now so we'll have the extra cash when the baby boomers retire. And that's the, when the baby boomers retire, the cash flow deficit becomes huge, and it's almost unsustainable. But you could have sustained it if you had built up the trust fund enough from what the top 1% are getting in the tax cuts. You could have built up the trust fund enough to have withstood the pressure of the baby boomers retiring. And we had a choice. You can make Social Security secure, or you can look out for the top 1%.
And this administration made that choice. Mr. Scott, I'm afraid our time is up. I want to thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop and answering these tough questions.
Look forward to coming back, Mark.
I really appreciate it. Well, you heard it. You heard from Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia giving you details, giving you facts, giving you figures. If the top 1%, if that tax cut hadn't happened, you could save Social Security for the next 75 years. Pretty strong stuff. We're going to go to a commercial break. When we come back, we're going to have a Republican congressman, a former Republican congressman. His name is Michael Forbes. He's a three-term congressman from New York, and he's going to give his point of view on the budget deficits. Tune in to more, and if you want to call in and ask him some questions, you can feel free to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with former Congressman Michael Forbes right after this.
I'm Michael Bednarik, and I approve this message.
President Bush got elected by claiming to be a compassionate conservative. Would a real conservative approve $500 billion in deficit spending in a single year? Would a real conservative send thousands of troops to Iraq while leaving our own borders vulnerable to both terrorists and lawless illegal aliens? Would a real conservative want to amend our Constitution 7 different ways? If you're fed up with electing Republicans who claim to be conservative and then govern like liberal Democrats, you do have an alternative. Michael Bednarik, the Libertarian candidate for president. Bush and Kerry aren't the only choices. Libertarian Michael Bednarik, the alternative for the real conservative. Visit Bednarik.org today or call 800-807-7552.
Hi, I'm Mark Levine, host of The Inside Scoop. We've heard some of the really strange and crazy ads by Republicans lately accusing John Kerry of all kinds of things, but this latest ad by www.liegirls.com, I think it goes over the top. What do you think?
It's too bad they changed the Constitution to let a Frenchman run for president. The only people who don't like the way George Bush is running the country are evildoers and the French. And they're all voting for John Kerry. John Kerry is so French that when he's in France, people are like, hey, Frenchy, Frenchman. John Kerry likes to eat cheese. John Kerry drinks French wine and eats fetal stem cells. John Kerry will kill every unborn child in the world. John Kerry will kill every newborn male child of the Hebrews. John Kerry does nuance, and so did Hitler. If John Kerry is elected, he'll appoint activist judges like Saddam Hussein to the Supreme Court. John Kerry says yes to drugs. John Kerry is the chief sponsor of terrorism. John Kerry is actually 5'2". Did you know that Vietnam used to be a democracy until John Kerry got there and taught the Orientals communism? If John Kerry couldn't stop Howard Dean from acquiring nuclear weapons, how's he going to stop Kim Jong-il? John Kerry wants to poison Medicare. So when your grandma takes her medicine, she'll be taking poison. John Kerry is going to kill you. He's hiding under your bed and he has a knife and there's nothing you can do, nowhere you can hide. You're already dead.
This message brought to you by www.liegirls.com. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. We heard in the first half of the hour from Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia, a Democrat, arguing that the Democrats are the fiscal conservatives. They're the ones who are watching your wallet. Whether or not it was that way in the past, he talked about Clinton budgets versus Bush budgets and concludes that Democrats are the ones who are more carefully watching your money. My next guest is former Congressman from New York, Michael Forbes, former Republican congressman, I should say, served 3 terms in that capacity. And I want to hear his views on which party is the best fiscal conservative. If you want to call in and ask former Congressman Forbes some questions, feel free to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can contribute to the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Congressman Forbes, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Mark, thanks a lot. It's great to be with you today.
I hope you enjoyed that very unusual commercial. It's amazing what they'll advertise sometimes. Let me ask you, get right to the grounds here of fiscal conservative. There are a number of people that will tell you, hey, I'm a social liberal. I'm pro-choice on abortion. I support the environment, civil rights. But I want government to watch our money. I don't want to run up these huge deficits. Who among Bush and Kerry would be better in this regard?
I think there's no doubt about it, Mark. John Kerry is the fiscal conservative. He is the one talking about making sure that we have some discipline back in the federal budget process. You know, few people remember, but when John Kerry was elected to the United States Senate, he was one of 3 Democrats to sign on to the Graham-Rudman-Hollings balanced budget effort, the effort, frankly, to put the brakes on federal spending. And later that was, replaced by a pay-as-you-go initiative. In other words, asking lawmakers with new initiatives to find, those dollars within the current initiatives to fund the new ones. And, you know, that's not really outlandish. It's ironic because back in 1994, and that's when I came in as a Republican, ironically, I ran as a fiscal conservative, somebody who wanted to balance the budget. And, you know, ironically, Republicans threw out Democrats back in 1994 because Democrats were believed to be, at that time, hugging the ideological edge way far to the left. They'd gone away from the mainstream, it was believed at the time. And ironically, here we are 10 years later after Republican rule in the Congress, and we are seeing, frankly, 4 years of George Bush. He has not vetoed one spending bill. He's not asked Americans to make any sacrifice whatsoever. And as a result, we have seen, you know, the wonderful surplus that was built up under the Clinton administration. We saw a $5.6 trillion surplus where we're going to use that money in part to save Social Security. And now we're dealing with a $4.6 trillion deficit. John Snow, the Treasury Secretary under George Bush, said to the Congress about a month ago that he didn't think America was going to be able to pay its bills without going and borrowing more money. We have a $7.3 trillion debt in this country, and it's Democrats that are talking about being fiscally responsible to put some discipline back in the budget process.
Now, obviously, you must think this is a change. You ran as a Republican. Did you desert your party, or did your party desert you?
Well, Mark, I feel very strongly that the Republican Party deserted me. You know, I spent 3 terms, as you noted, in the Congress. Increasingly, I found that the ideological right wing, the extreme right, that was defining the National Republican Party was out of step with most Americans. And I mean Republicans as well as Democrats. And we see today, a decade later, that in fact this is the case. Even when, the fiscally responsible in the Congress tried to put back in pay-as-you-go, initiatives to temper the way that this spendthrift Congress under the Republicans has gone wild, even that was beaten back by the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. And so I think today, you know, John Kerry is the one out on the stump talking about putting some discipline back into the federal budget process, making sure that we make priorities and we pay for those priorities, unlike George Bush, who's thrown any kind of fiscal discipline out the window. I think we see, that the choice next Tuesday is going to be somebody who is going to be able to, assert the priorities that we as Democrats have been talking about, that John Kerry has made the hallmark of his campaign, and yet also do that within the constraints of fiscal discipline.
Now, Mr. Forbes, I hear Republican spin meisters all over the TV, and in fact, I have a number of people who've written on my blog, and they're arguing that John Kerry can't possibly pay for all the programs he has. I've heard George Bush say it. How do you answer that charge?
Well, first of all, John Kerry had provided, and I would encourage people who are still on the fence to go to johnkerry.com and look at John Kerry's program. He has the most thoughtful, in-depth, extensively laid out program of any presidential candidate in modern memory. And they've been very thoughtful at the Kerry campaign to, lay it out chapter and verse. And will John Kerry be able to pay for his program? Of course he will, because a couple of things are inherent to his program that don't even exist in the Bush program. Number one, the tax benefits that have gone to the wealthiest Americans, to the most exclusive corporations in this country and the wealthiest Americans, John Kerry is going to put some equilibrium back in the tax process. He's going to make sure that the middle class, which has taken the biggest hit under George Bush, is actually going to benefit, and those who are more wealthy in this country that have the ability to pay their fair share, they are the ones who are going to be paying, the over $200,000 a year crowd, they're the ones who are going to be back paying their fair share, and let the middle class, which has taken a disproportionate burden under George Bush, not only a disproportionate burden of making sure that the wealthiest get these benefits, but they've also taken it on the chin at the gas pump, they've taken it on the chin in home heating oil, they've taken it on the chin in higher tuition costs for their children to go to college. They've taken it on the chin on their health care premiums. And these are the folks that John Kerry is talking to, and he's going to make that front and center part of his agenda, and he's going to pay for that. He's going to pay for it by making sure that when Congress passes his initiatives, that they're going to find savings in other existing programs that no longer work. He's going to take the money, the fair share being paid by the wealthiest Americans, and apply that to some of these programs to help the middle-class families in this country deal with this burden. Under George Bush in the last 4 years, we've seen family income drop $1,500 a year.
And the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. I have to say, Mr. Forbes, for an ex-Republican, you sound awfully like a Democrat. do you think that the Republican Party was different 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
I do. I absolutely do. And look, I'm a former Republican. I come from New York. You know, and like most Americans, you know, we believe in moderation. When I was a Republican, I believed it was good to be a steward of our environment, to make sure that we had the controls in place that would give us cleaner air and cleaner water. And, you know, this crowd of extremist right-wing Republicans has, you know, given away any pretense to protecting the environment. If they have another 4 years, they are hopeful of you know, going back and drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Reserve. They want to undo all of the accomplishments that have been, you know, frankly, that even started during the Nixon administration in trying to preserve the environment, for example. And I think 4 years of war of George Bush is something that this country cannot afford.
Well, you know, I know you used to serve on the Appropriations Committee, right?
Yes.
Did you ever see the kind of huge pork bill that we just saw pass Congress just a couple weeks ago, the one that aids bow and arrow manufacturers and people who make fish tackle boxes and makers of Chinese ceiling fans, not to mention the big things going to oil companies and tobacco farmers and just huge billions of dollars, taxpayer money, just going out there. One provision I saw even aided foreign gamblers, which of course is a very important constituency. I don't know whose. Did that kind of thing happen in the 90s? Is it happening more now?
Well, you know, just when you think you've seen it all, Mark, and I know you are particularly a student of the Congress, and you're.
I used to work there. I didn't have the job you did.
I
was a lawyer on the Judiciary and Homeland Security Committee.
Right, right. And you've seen up close and personal, you know, where I'm sure both of us can point in years past to what we thought was, you know, unbelievable largesse.
Is it worse now? Do you think
it's worse than ever now? Absolutely.
How do you judge that?
Well, I think Republicans, it's kind of like a Trojan horse, if you will, or, a lamb in sheep, a lamb in wolf's clothing. I think Republicans feel that they can hoodwink the public enough that they've somehow earned the mantle of being fiscal conservatives. And so hiding under that, you know, false pretense of the public, they think the public knowing somehow that they're fiscal conservatives, that in fact they have passed some of the most outrageous and excessive spending programs in the history of the country. And that alone is reason why not only do we need to elect John Kerry, our president, on November 2nd, next Tuesday, but I believe very, very firmly that we need to, you know, throw out a lot of these Republican congressional and congressmen and women and elect Democrats to the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. And I believe, you know, we are on the threshold of seeing a dramatic change because Americans, I often said, Mark, that I think that the American public is way ahead of the politicians. And no better example than the upcoming election. I think we're going to see some dramatic changes, things that the media are not right now talking about.
Congressman Forbes, might you run again as a Democrat?
Well, you know, you never say never, Mark.
Okay.
I'm committed, you know, working for the election of John Kerry and obviously hoping that we're going to be able to elect more Democrats to the House of Representatives. And I hope that we can, you know, right the ship of state here. Never has this nation been so divided from its allies, and never have the American people been so divided amongst themselves, frankly, because of the ideological extremism that is now prevalent in the Congress under the Republicans.
Last question. I I hear what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying. But I go and I turn on CNN, MSNBC, not to mention Fox News, and I see George Bush stumping all around the country. And what is he saying? He's saying John Kerry is a big spending liberal. And he says that again and again and again. He says John Kerry can't fund his programs. He says, you know, if you're out to stop big spending liberals, vote for me. It's an amazing disconnect. How does he get away with that?
Well, you're right, and it's laughable, because if you tally up all the promises that George Bush has made over the last 3 or 4 months, he actually is about $1.5 trillion in excess of spending over the thoughtful programs of John Kerry. I think that, you know, George Bush is not going to get away with it. As I said, I really believe that the American people are smarter than that. They see the fear tactics of the Bush campaign. You know, I was talking to a congressional friend of mine just a couple of hours ago, and I have the same feeling today that I had as I watched George Bush's father go down to defeat against Bill Clinton in 1992. There's a panic that's in the Republican side. There's, this kind of a vitriolic rhetoric that's going on over there. And I think that they really see what a lot of Americans, I think, are coming to realize over the next couple of days and even over the last few days, and that is that the tide is shifting and that Americans, they really do want to see some balance back in Washington. And I think they're going to unleash this ironclad grip that Republicans have had on the White House and on the Congress.
Well, Congressman Forbes, I hope you're right. I have trouble sleeping at nights waiting for this election. I sure hope you're right. I know many of my listeners do, and you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for what you're doing, and we appreciate the Inside Scoop.
Well, when we come back, I'm going to be reading from an endorsement from a surprising person. His name is Scott McConnell. He's the executive editor of the American Conservative magazine, and lo and behold, he has endorsed John Kerry. Also, when we come back, I want to let you know about the secret Republican plans to remove voters from the voting rolls in Ohio and Florida. I've reported on this before, but there are more details, even worse things, specifically targeting black voters. I'm going to get to that, and then I got to conclude with a comment about this year's World Series. We'll be right back.
Bring you tidings of great joy. At last, our Congress critters have done something tangible to lift people up from the economic doldrums. They've raised wages in America. You're not silly enough to think for a moment that Congress would raise your wages, are you? No, Nanette. For the past several years, they've kept the minimum wage in our country stuck at the paltry poverty level of $5.15 an hour. It's their wages that they've just raised again. By again, I refer to the fact that this is the sixth pay hike that our lawmakers have bestowed upon themselves in the past 6 years. This time, the members will pocket an extra $4,000 each, raising their gross pay to about $162,000 a year. Of course, congressional leaders don't do such dirty work directly. Instead, these steady increases, now totaling some $25,000 over the 6 years, have come surreptitiously. Each year, an automatic congressional increase is tucked deep inside the mammoth appropriation bill for the Treasury Department, a bill that always passes. So members always get a raise, unless they choose to deny themselves by specifically voting to remove the automatic hike. Thus far, they've shown remarkable restraint in this regard. One bold member who keeps trying to say no to this help-yourself dip into the taxpayers' gravy is Jim Matheson, Democrat of Utah. Again this year, Matheson called for a vote on the $4,000 increase. But by a tally of 235 to 170, his colleagues rejected his procedural motion, thus avoiding even having to cast a direct public vote on their money grab. This is Jim Hightower saying, at a time when the wages of average Americans have fallen in terms of buying power, it's good to know whose side your Congress critter is on. To learn how your member of Congress voted on Matheson's attempt at honesty, call Taxpayers for Common Sense, 1-800-TAXPAYER.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens. Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
Your oldest has just turned driving age. Time to add him to your policy. So you get in your car, drive down to your insurance company. Hunt for a space, double park, get a parking ticket, get in a fight with the meter maid, get thrown in jail, meet a guy named Wally. Wait a minute. This is just a bad dream. You've got Geico. You don't have to drive anywhere. You can do all that car insurance stuff online. Oh, that was a close one.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. Online at geico.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We've been talking about the budget, about fiscal conservatism, and how John Kerry really is better fiscal conservative than George W. Bush. We've heard from Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia, former Republican Congressman, apparently now a Democrat, Michael Forbes of New York. And I want to read to you, as the coup de grace, if you will, a very surprising endorsement of John Kerry by Scott McConnell, the executive editor of the American Conservative magazine. And hey, if you want to call in, you still are free to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. It's really an amazing endorsement. Now, the American Conservative magazine couldn't come to a conclusion. Some endorsed a Libertarian candidate. But Scott McConnell, the executive editor, he endorsed John Kerry. And I want to read this at length. If you want to read the endorsement in full, all you have to do is go to the website. It's right there. You can click on it. The endorsement is entitled Kerry's the One. And Scott McConnell begins by saying, there's little in John Kerry's persona or platform that appeals to conservative. The flip-flopper charge seems overdone, but Kerry is plainly a conventional liberal and no future candidate for an addition of profiles and courage. But, Scott McConnell writes, this election is not about John Kerry. If he were to win, his dearth of charisma would likely ensure him a single term. Remember, this is a conservative writing. Scott McConnell writes, Kerry would face challenges from within his own party and a thwarting of his most expensive initiatives by a Republican Congress. Much of his presidency would be absorbed by trying to clean up the mess left to him in Iraq. He would be constrained by the swollen deficits and a ripe target for the next Republican nominee. It is instead an election about the presidency of George W. Bush. To the surprise of virtually everyone, Bush has turned into an important president and in many ways the most radical America has had since the 19th century. The libertarian writer Lou Rockwell has mischievously noted parallels between Bush and Russia's last czar, Nicholas II. Both gained office as a result of family connections. Both initiated an unnecessary war that shattered their country's budgets. Bush, Scott McConnell writes, has behaved like a caricature of what a right-wing president is supposed to be, and his continuation in office will discredit any sort of conservatism for generations. The executive editor of the American Conservative magazine, Scott McConnell, writes, the launching of an invasion against a country that posed no threat to the U.S., the doling out of war profits and concessions to politically favored corporations, the financing of the war by ballooning the deficit to be passed on to the nation's children, the ceaseless drive to cut taxes for those outside the middle class and working poor. It is as if Bush sought to resurrect every false 1960s era left-wing cliche about predatory imperialism and turn it into administration policy. During the campaign, few have paid attention to how much the Bush presidency has degraded the image of the United States in the world. Of course, there's always been anti-Americanism, but Bush has somehow managed to take all these sentiments and turbocharge them. In Europe and indeed all over the world, Bush has made the United States despised by people who used to be its friends, by businessmen in the middle classes, by moderate and sensible liberals. Never before have democratic foreign governments needed to demonstrate disdain for Washington to their own electorates in order to survive in office. The poll numbers are shocking. In countries like Norway, Germany, France, and Spain, Bush is liked by about 7% of the populace. Bush has accomplished this by giving the U.S. a novel foreign policy doctrine under which it arrogates to itself the right to invade any country it wants if it feels threatened. It is an American version of the Brezhnev Doctrine, but the latter was at least confined to Eastern Europe. If the analogy seems extreme, what is an appropriate comparison when a country manufactures falsehoods about a foreign government, disseminates them widely, and invades the country on the basis of those falsehoods? It is not an action that any American president has ever taken before. It is not something that good countries do. He goes on and explains how it has increased terrorism worldwide, and how if Kerry wins, this magazine will be in opposition to him from inauguration day forward. But he concludes that in order to preserve conservatism, you have to elect John Kerry, because George W. Bush, quote-unquote, has come to embody a politics that is antithetical to almost any kind of thoughtful conservatism. Pretty strong stuff from the executive editor of the American Conservative magazine. There are a number of things I still want to talk about. Some of them I may have to wait until next week. Excuse me, until tomorrow. We'll be on tomorrow. We'll be talking, in fact, about the Supreme Court. But I do want to mention what's going on in Florida and Ohio. It seems there is a massive Republican effort to go in there with the names of black voters. I'm not making this up, folks. To go in there with the names of black voters and try to disqualify them. What they're going to do is they're going to challenge each of them. And even though these challenges have no basis in law, indeed they're against the Voting Rights Act, which preserve the right of blacks to vote, they hope that by creating long enough lines, they can discourage blacks from voting. There are lists that have gone out in Jacksonville, Florida, that consist in almost entirely of black names or in black districts. And in fact, there's a very interesting piece reported by Greg Palast for the BBC, not reported here in the United States, about these names. It's a list of 2,000 names in Jacksonville, Florida. And what's interesting is that the Republican spokespeople, when asked about this list, said, well, this is just our return mail list from people we sent fundraising solicitations to. They sent fundraising solicitations to all these black voters in Jacksonville. But Republican state campaign spokeswoman Mindy Tucker Fletcher, though she said the list was not put together to create a challenge list, she refused to say it would not be used in that manner. And in fact, these clerical matters, this list, was sent to top officials of the Bush campaign in Florida and in Washington. Meanwhile, a judge in Florida has ruled that 10,000 Floridians are barred from voting because they did exactly what we talked about here on the Inside Scoop. They signed that they were citizens, but they didn't check a box. What did the Florida officials do? Exactly what we talked about. They delayed notifying these voters there was anything wrong with their form until, oh, it was too late after the election. And the federal district court judge has now barred 10,000 Floridians from voting. But that's not all. That's not all. 58,000 absentee ballots in Broward County, a very heavily Democratic county in Florida that includes Fort Lauderdale, are now missing. 58,000 missing absentee ballots. This was reported on local TV news, Local 10, and they don't know what happened to them. They have no idea. The post office doesn't know either. Oops. I guess if you live in Broward County, you lose your right to vote. It's shocking stuff, my friends. Shocking stuff. I also wanted to talk about the retraction of the story on NBC that about the 380 tons of weapons. I don't have enough time to do that. That'll have to happen tomorrow. I do want to conclude, though, by talking about the World Series. Okay, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Red Sox fan. I admit it. And I'm proud that 2 weeks ago, way before the American League Championship, I predicted the Red Sox would not only win the American League, they would win the World Series, and that John Kerry would become president. At that time, a number of you said, Mark, please don't put the curse of the Bambino on John Kerry. If you're not a baseball fan, you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. But the Red Sox haven't won since 1918, and I suspect they will pull out a victory quite soon, as will John Kerry. And I would argue that the reason the Red Sox were able to beat the Yankees is precisely the reason why John Kerry is going to beat George W. Bush. The Yankees were arrogant. They were sure they had won. They didn't spend time on the fundamentals. They didn't spend time on policy, if you will, on how to win a baseball game. Instead, they rested on their laurels. They expected a curse to carry them through. The Republicans are doing the same. They're not even trying to reach out to the center. They're only reaching out to the right-wing conservatives. And instead of working on policies to attract voters, they're working on policies to prevent voters from voting. They're spending all their time trying to prevent blacks from voting instead of finding ways to attract Democratic voters to their side. Now, probably it's too late for that. Probably people know who George Bush is, and the only way he can win is by the fraud and illegal measures that Republicans are doing right now. But I have to say, like the Red Sox, I have hope. I do believe that John Kerry in 6 days will be elected the next president of the United States. And if they try fraud, if they try litigation, if it comes to the courts, I am ready to give my services as a constitutional lawyer to help the cause, to help John Kerry become president of the United States. Because at the end of the day, it is your votes that should count, not the votes of the Supreme Court. And tomorrow, we're going to talk